Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're talking about one of the largest wildfires in Minnesota history right now with the author of a new book. Kerry Griffith with us by phone. He's the author of a number of books, including Opening Goliath, that won the 2010 Minnesota Book Award, and the book Wolves, a winner of the Midwest Book Award. His latest is Gunflint Burning, Fire in the Boundary Waters. Maybe you remember the 2007 Ham Lake fire. And maybe you've had some experiences surrounding forest fires. Certainly, you may have visited the Gunflint area in northern Minnesota. Love to hear from you as we talk with our guests. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Kerry Griffith, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's an honor to be on your show, and I'm a huge advocate of Wisconsin Public Radio, so it's a real privilege.
You know, when I got your book, I took a look at the cover, and I thought, you know, this book could go a couple of different ways. It could be a sort of a dry book, you know, with facts and figures, or, since I've read your other work, it could be more like what Kerry Griffith would do. And I defy anyone to read the prologue of your book and not be compelled to turn the next page to chapter one in that prologue when you've got Bob Manahan, who's 76 years old, and the fire's bearing down on him, and the deputy, was it Tim Weitz?
Tim Weitz, yeah.
Yeah, Tim Weitz telling him he's got, you know, you really need to get out of here, and he says, I'm staying. Wow.
Yeah, that is a very dramatic opening, and it really, the reason I did it that way was obviously to compel readers to give it a chance and keep reading, but Bob Monahan also surfaced sort of the, in a very personal way, the devastation of that fire. So I'm really glad you enjoyed that.
Oh, it was a great way to get the book started, and then it just kept going from there. It was great. What made you want to write a book about this? And you do talk about that a little bit in the beginning of your book.
Well, yeah, I mean, to be honest, Larry, I didn't know a lot about forest fires or fighting forest fires, but all I knew is that I had heard that they were good for the forest from an ecological perspective, although they do significant damage periodically up in northeastern Minnesota. It's they've had fires up there for tens of thousands of years, so it's part of the natural cycle that happens. So I was interested in knowing more about that. I've always loved northeastern Minnesota. And I've always been really interested in forests. And then when I started getting into the fire itself, sort of exploring it for a topic idea, there were a lot of things about the Ham Lake fire in particular that were very different from many of the other forest fires that have happened in Minnesota and Wisconsin, for that matter. Even though it wasn't the largest in Minnesota history, it was significant for numerous reasons. One, some of you alluded to in the beginning there, which were it was extremely devastating and extremely costly fire for man-made structures. And then, because I didn't know anything about it, I'm always interested in learning about new things like modern wildfire fighting. And even though it wasn't the largest fire in the last in Minnesota history, it wasn't even in the top 10. It's number 12. But that said, it was the largest in Minnesota in almost a century for numerous reasons. And I was interested in sort of exploring that. And then finally, one of the things that, since you read the book, you're familiar with, but this was the only fire of the top 12 in Minnesota that was started by a camper. Yeah. So I was kind of interested in exploring how that came about and what happened to the camper and that side of the story as well.
Yeah, and that was a fascinating part of it. And of course, early on, your first chapters, you're writing about what happened there with Steve Posniak on that fateful day in May. You know, but we should back up for a minute, but just to mention the Gunflint Trail. Explain where it is, what that area looked like in 2007, and then we can go from there.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I shared this book with my mother-in-law, who lives in Colorado and is not that familiar with northeastern Minnesota, has never been up the Gunflint Trail, and she said, "I never knew the Gunflint Trail was a highway." And so for your listeners who may not have been there, the Gunflint Trail starts in Grand Marais up in northeastern Minnesota, and it goes really west-northwest up and for about 60 miles. It's a two-lane blacktop through beautiful forest. It goes for about 60 miles up into the heart of the Boundary Waters. It's surrounded on the north, south, and west by the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. So it's filled with cabin owners and resort owners and, you know, people and businesses like that.
Well, I've been there, and it is an absolutely beautiful, beautiful area. You know what? Let's just get John in Dubuque in here. He's been waiting a bit. John, thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. How you doing, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been up to Gunflint probably 10 or 12 times. We used to go up there as a kid with the family, and I remember driving through there. One year, we actually did go to the Ham Lake area and look at where the fire was started. I thought that was kind of interesting. I didn't realize it was actually started by a camper. I'm actually looking forward to getting out today. I'm definitely going to buy the book. I actually kind of wish I would have waited to call. I wanted to hear a little bit more what your guest had to say.
Well, I tell you what, you'll have plenty of opportunity to do that, right? So stay listening, John, for goodness sake, stay listening. And it's interesting, John is somebody who's camped up there, and one of the fascinating parts of the book for me were you've got a group of three people who were there. You've got Posniak, who was the guy that started the fire, another group of seven or eight people who were out there when the fire started, and a couple of other groups as well. And I thought weaving in their personal stories as you went along was great.
Yeah, that was very interesting. And all of those stories that you allude to played pivotal roles in the first 3 days of the fire, in the start of the fire, and in the first 3 days. And to John's point, you know, I've paddled into that Ham Lake, and it's a beautiful area. And that particular campsite that Steve Posniak, the guy who started the fire, was on early in the season. You know, he went up there. This was not his first rodeo. This was his 27th visit to the area. He always went the same time every year. He'd go the weekend before
fishing season.
Yeah, fishing season. And you'd think he'd have the entire place to himself, and that's what he usually did. But you alluded to the party of eight Forest Service Air Resource Management people that were up there. They actually paddled up and ended up camping in a campsite about a quarter mile down from Steve Posniak. Of course, he didn't know they were Forest Service people or anything like that, but they were in the book too, and they played a pivotal role in identifying Steve Posniak. And then the other story that I tell in the book, in part, in addition to other stories, but was a really poignant story about Gus Axelson, a freelance writer from the Twin Cities, Lane Kennedy, an outdoors photographer, well known in Minnesota and the upper Midwest. And Professor Lee Frelick, who's a forestry professor at the University of Minnesota. Coincidentally, the fire started, as you mentioned at the start of your program, on May 5th. On May 4th, Gus, Lane, and Lee we're starting on a three-day canoeing trip out of Seagull Lake, which is at the end of the Gunflint Trail, out of Seagull Lake, and they were going to write a story about the effects, for Backpacker Magazine, about the effects of climate change and fire on the boreal forest.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, if you can believe it, you had one of the area's foremost experts on the impact of fires and climate change on the forest, Lee Frelick. And here he ends up being on that lake and actually getting stranded because the winds are so strong, getting stranded, and he has a front row seat, he and Gus Lane, to one of the most seminal events in Minnesota history that, you know, he is extremely familiar with. So I love to tell that story. All these side stories I tell in there were designed to surface different details about the fire. And Lee's presence and, you know, his just the synchronicity of him being there at that time were put in there to sort of surface Lee's expertise and knowledge about the area and about forest fires in general.
Yeah, it's it was great. By the way, just I was going to mention this later, but while I'm thinking about it, have you sold the movie rights to this?
No, I haven't.
Oh, but I think
another
this...
Another person mentioned it.
I think this would make a great movie.
Well, I do too. You know, Larry, I have to say, I mentioned several reasons why I wrote this book, but the more I got into it, and I think I hope it comes through in the book, the people and the community of the Gunflint Trail are just incredible. The way they came together and the altruism they exhibited and just the way they all chipped in and fought that fire and helped each other out. You know, some of these people are competitive resort owners, but, you know, they, when push comes to shove, they really join forces. And that was a big part of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jim in Turtle Lake, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yes, I've been to Boundary Water several times. Canoe is beautiful up there, but I was just going to say my son is a wildland firefighter out of Cody, Wyoming. Well, they're actually out of Grey Bull, Wyoming. He's a Wyoming hotshot. And they're in Durango, Colorado right now on a fire, but they had a chance to go to the Boundary Waters about 2 years ago and fight a fire up there. And he said it was great to be on flat land for one thing, but anyway, there's some wonderful, if you go to Wyoming Hotshots website, there's wonderful pictures of some tremendous fires. There's a kid by the name of Kyle Miller that he's been considered for National Geographic pictures, and there's a lot of really beautiful shots of wildfires, and there's even a few of them from when they were in the Boundary Waters.
Oh, Jim, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And actually, Carrie, there were some hot shots that came up for that fire, for the Boundary Waters fire, the Ham Lake fire.
Yeah, there were. And I was going to say to Jim, you know, kudos to him and especially his son. I mean, those hot shot firefighters are, they really are hot shots. I mean, they're really superlative firefighters, and they get those roles and get in those teams that travel all over the U.S. and up into Alaska because they are so good at what they do. And, you know, just to give your listeners a sense of what that involves, Jim said his son was happy to be in flat land, but actually if you go up into the area where the Boundary Waters burned, it's pretty rugged.
Yes, it
and
is.
Yeah. You've been there before. Yeah. So, you know, it is very rugged country. It is very thick, forested. And then, you know, a lot of the hotshot people, now this wasn't true with Jim's son because he's familiar with the area, and he's from Turtle Lake, it sounds like, but a lot of them were unfamiliar with working around lakes. So they had to be trained in how to p- paddle canoes and in water safety. Because remember, at this time of the year, I think the day that Gus Lane and Lee started out on Seagull Lake, the water temperature was 37 degrees. So that's dangerous territory when you get up into there. But yeah, the hotshot crews there were two at least hotshot crews on that fire, at least in the first 3 days.
Kerry Griffith, our guest today, he is the author of Gunflint Burning, Fire in the Boundary Waters. A fascinating book. We're going to be talking some more with him. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Sarah Hopeful, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking today with Kerry Griffith, author of Gunflint Burning. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Call in 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. And this whole thing, you know, just before our little break there, Kerry, we were talking about, you were mentioning the difference when you're fighting a fire among a whole bunch of lakes. To me, a fascinating part of the book was the sprinkler systems that some folks had in their homes and how firefighters were able to draw water from the lakes to fight.
Yeah, that was an unexpected part of the story, in part because those sprinkler systems, George Carlson, the guy who pioneered and sort of created those sprinkler systems initially back in the 1990s after the blowdown. He calls them fire mitigation systems. And it turns out that when the Ham Lake fire happened, there were about 64 of those. There were more than 100. There were more than 100 up along the Gunflint Trail that resort owners and cabin owners had installed. And just for your listeners' information, one of these sprinkler systems, it might have 20 sprinklers spread around the property. And if you run a sprinkler and then it pulls the water from the lake and using a gas-powered pump, if you run one of those systems for 24 hours with 20 sprinklers, it's equivalent to a 2-inch rainfall. It's like dropping 100,000 gallons on your property. And they thought, the theory at least was, prior to the Ham Lake fire, that if you did that, your property would be safe from fire for 7 to 10 days. But of course, it had never been tested because they were so new. But of the 64 that they got up and operational, many of them they did not, because it was so early in the year, May 5th, and the ice just off most of the lakes up there, that many of the people that had the systems didn't have them up and running yet. But of the 64 that were operational, I think they saved 63 structures. So those water systems turned out to be really significant, and for the first time they were tested, and they did an incredible job.
Yeah, they did. And you write about... is it Ron and Kelly Berg were two of the, what they called the Seagull Seven. When the fire took a turn right at them with the wind, and they sat and ran back and forth to each other's homes and so forth and tried to save and saved a lot of their homes.
Yeah, you know, something else I didn't realize. And, you know, Jim referenced the fires going on in Durango, and there's a lot of fires out west. When people get evacuated, I used to think, okay, they got evacuated, they have to leave, they're forced out of their homes. But the truth is that no one can make you leave your home. Now, there are obvious things they can do to impress upon you the severity of the situation. For example, with Bob Monahan, who ignored the evacuation, with Deputy Tim Weitz came to his door, he said, "No, I'm not going." And Deputy Tim Weitz said, "Well, okay, well, I need to know, you know, the names and where I can reach your next of kin." And usually, I'm told that when when the people evacuating, the law enforcement folks operating the evacuation, when they mentioned that, they convinced people to leave. But Bob Monahan didn't, and neither did the Seagull 7. Now, if you talk to firefighters up there, they say they don't like that they stayed. But that said, I think Bob and the Seagull 7, by staying behind and fighting the fire, mostly by making sure their sprinkler systems were operational and functioning, they actually saved some structures.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Parker in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Parker.
Hi, Larry, and thanks so much for this particular show. My wife and I have gone up the Gunflint Trail to the Gunflint Lodge every summer for 20 years. And for that reason, we have experienced both the great blowdown of 1999, the derecho, that left, I think, something like a million trees on both sides of the border snapped in half, tinder for fires to come. And then, of course, we were there in the wake of the Ham Lake fire. And on both occasions, we experienced many things up there, and one of them is indeed the resilience and beauty of the people and of that community, as your author has said. But one of the things I particularly wanted to remark about is that each time after the blowdown and after Ham Lake, we wondered, do we want to return again because the place has been so scarred and damaged? I'm awfully glad we did, because what we got to experience is the resilience of the natural world. It's quite amazing. And if you're approaching 80 years of age, as I am, it's quite encouraging and reassuring to see the bounce-back capacity of nature. And I just wanted to throw that in as an upside of some of this, and I wonder what you and your author might have to say about it.
Oh, Parker, I'm really glad you called. Thank you so much for calling. Carrie, a comment. Carrie, are you there?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was gonna say I'm really glad Parker both made that comment, but also followed up and kept going up there. He has seen two of the huge, climatological events or catastrophes that happened up there. And actually, it was more like 30 million trees that were blown over in that derecho you mentioned. But, what's really interesting about what Parker said is he referenced the Gunflint Lodge, and he's been going up there for 20 years. The Gunflint Lodge was sort of on the front lines of where the fire happened. In fact, it almost burned, and it would have burned if the Forest Service hadn't done a big burnout that I cover in the book. But one of the things that I recognized when I went up there after the fire, like Parker did, is how devastated the Gunflint Lodge is on the south side of a beautiful Gunflint Lake. It's a 20-mile-long big body of water. It's very beautiful. If you look across the lake from the Gunflint Lodge's patio, you look out over the water, crystal, beautiful blue water, and you look to the other side. And prior to the Ham Lake fire, that was such a beautiful scene because the other side was just covered by trees and forest, and it just looked rich and healthy and everything else. Well, the Ham Lake fire, the burnout that I mentioned, was on the west side of the lake, and it forced the fire to go north up into Canada because there were at least $20 million worth of structures, including the Gunflint Lodge, on the west and south end of the lake. And so they pushed it into that forest up there, and they burned the whole north side of that lake. And my wife and I coincidentally happened to be up there on May 23rd of 2007. So we looked across that lake, like I think Parker was mentioning, we looked across that lake, and it just looked so devastated. It was blackened, and it looked like a moonscape, and the fire had burned all the trees and foliage, and it had surfaced all the rock that's up there, big, domes of Canadian Shield granite. And it just looked terrible. But in the ensuing years, now it's been 11 years since the fire, that area has really come back. You don't see the fires, or you don't see the forest across Gunflint Lodge, across the lake, but you see it's very green. There's a lot of moose browse. Blueberry picking is probably phenomenal over there. I haven't been over to that side. The forest and everything has really come back, and it harkens back to my initial comment that I had heard that forest fires were good for the forest, and they are. They actually, you know, some things like jack pines don't even germinate until they get burned by a fire. So, you know, there are a lot of positive things that happen, and the forest has really come back, and the moose in particular have benefited because there's so much more moose browse now.
I've paddled across that exact area that you were talking about. It really is a beautiful area. I've stayed at the Gunflint Lodge myself. And Parker, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. The whole business about fires, and you write about this in the book, if a fire is started by lightning, for example, it's the thought is it should be left to burn. But if it's man-made, then you fight it. Is that basically, certainly they would fight yep. Fires that are around structures and so forth, even in a lightning fire, I would think. But is that the general thought?
Yeah, that's exactly and again, I didn't know that prior to writing the book and interviewing the Forest Service people that I did, but that is the prevailing policy, and that's been a long-term policy. If it is a natural, well, as time has gone on over the decades, the Forest Service and naturalists and foresters and people like Lee Frelick have recognized the value of forest fires as part of the natural process in an ongoing forest ecology. And so the Forest Service, if it's natural, like you mentioned, Larry, if it lightning happens in almost all of the top 12 forest fires in Minnesota history were started by lightning. If it starts naturally, what they do, I forget the exact phrase, but they manage the burn. They let it burn, but they manage the burn. Forest Service is always doing prescribed burns, so they'll take an area of anywhere from 10 to 2,000 acres, and they'll actually burn it in a prescribed burn. And the idea is that you're sort of managing the forest and getting rid of a lot of dead wood and burnable fuel that if a forest fire actually did happen, it could make the forest fire that much more deadly. So they do prescribed burns all the time. So when natural fires happen, they try to let it burn. But, of course, they always try and protect structures, property. So they're always doing that, too. So they're kind of weighing a lot of variables there. But you're absolutely right. If it starts naturally, they try to let it burn.
And you tell a compelling story, and it's a good story for anybody to read who does camp anywhere about Tim Pozniak, or Steve Pozniak, excuse me, and about how the fire probably got going. And he, you know, he did a kind of a dumb thing. He burned the trash paper that he had, and that's probably what set it all off.
Yeah, it is, and it was a real tragedy. You know, as I mentioned before, this was his 27th year. He came up all the time. He almost always went solo. He had a little tradition that you were alluding to, Larry. He was a news hound, so he'd bring newspaper with him, and he'd always burn the newspaper and whatever other paper trash he had before he paddled out. Now, your listeners who have been up into the Boundary Waters know that that's against regulations, but I think it was just sort of his tradition, so we always did it. And that particular morning, the temperature was starting to rise. It was getting unseasonably warm. More importantly, there was a big wind starting to kick up. So, yeah, what we think happened sounds pretty much this is what he said after he came out. He burned that trash. He thought it was out. He went down to start. It was the day he was going to paddle out. He went down and started packing up his supplies and getting his camp in order. And while he was gone, the wind must have picked up an ember and dropped it. The other thing is, it was really dry during that time. The Forest Service hadn't called a fire ban, but it was pretty dry. And something caught, and he tried to put it out, but the wind just blew it into a force that he just couldn't reckon with.
And those first 5 days or so is where you go into the most detail. And it was really fascinating to me to see the kind of planning that the Forest Service and the local officials up there have in place for fighting a fire. So there's type 3, type 2, type 1 fires, and when do you call a type 2 fire, a type 1 fire, and so forth?
Yeah, that was a real interest. The whole thing about modern firefighting is how sophisticated it has become and how it is sort of regimented. You were alluding to the incident command system. That's true for any natural disaster, but the Forest Service, of course, is for fighting fires, has very specific details about how you elevate a fire from a... at first, it was a type 4 incident, where the lowest is type 5, which is like a campfire that got out of hand. But quickly, the Ham Lake fire became a type 4, and while the Forest Service type 4 incident commander was driving up, it started at Ham Lake, is about 47 miles up the Gunflint Trail. So in route, the guy looked at how big the smoke plume was and everything else, and he called back to the Forest Service Center in Grand Marais and talked to Kurt Schierenbeck and said, we need to elevate this to a type 3 right away. And then over the next 24 hours and 48 hours, it was elevated to a type 2. Higher you go, of course, the more resources it takes to fight the fire, the bigger the fire is. And within 48 hours, it had been elevated to a type 1. And the type 1, Jim, the previous caller, was talking about hot shots. What a type 1 incident does is trigger the fire, effort to the front of the line in the whole national incident command system. So they get first call on all kinds of resources, plane resources, helicopters, hotshot crews, everything else. And that's what happened. So, yeah, I covered in detail the first 3 to 5 days, in large part because that's when there were 144 structures that were destroyed in the Ham Lake fire, and that they were almost all destroyed. 140 of the 44 were destroyed in the first 3 days.
And it was interesting to me, too. You make a reference there for the man or woman who has to make that call to make it a type 1 fire, and if it doesn't turn out to be a type 1 type fire, your career is kind of on the line. You got to think about that.
Well, you do. I mean, the firefighting costs alone for the Ham Lake fire were estimated at about 11 or 12 million. And so you can imagine that if you happen to be the forest supervisor is the person that ultimately has to call it. In this, the forest supervisor in this case was Jim Sanders, I think was his name, out of Duluth. But he was responsible for calling it. But it's not something to be done lightly because as I mentioned before, if you call a type 1, massive resources are brought to the fire, and many of them come from out west and all over the nation. And that costs a lot of money. So you can imagine what would happen if he called a type 1 and all these resources come in and it rains the next day and puts the fire out. Well, you know, he wouldn't look very good. So, yeah, it's politically dicey for those guys.
Yeah, I would bet. And there were so many coincidences of, I remember you, the DNR guy driving south and meets the Cook County Sheriff going north right after the fire was contained or was gone. Tell us what happened.
Well, that was a really poignant moment because here you've got Tom. Now, if you've met these guys, Tom Lynch was a structure protection specialist with the DNR, with the Minnesota DNR. And, you know, that previous day he had lost several structures and he had fought all day and all night to try and he saved many, many structures. And he's a real rugged sort of individualist guy and really knows his business. He's been fighting fires for 20 or 30 years. And then there was Sheriff Mark Falk, who, you know, the law enforcement has a whole different area of responsibility. They're in charge of evacuations and managing the traffic and managing the roadblocks and all that other kind of stuff up there. And working with the volunteer fire departments, there were 7 working on the fire. So the day after is dawn breaks, and they happen to be way at the end of the trail, which is smoldering and blackened and smoky, and they pass each other going in opposite directions. They both roll down their windows, and they had just been through a major battle with this forest fire, and they both, they don't look at it. They've gone, and they're sort of surveying the damage each on their own, and as they pass, they roll down the windows, and they both begin to cry. And it was a really sort of moving, if you meet these two guys, that it moved them enough to make them tear up like that was just a real big moment that definitely sort of captured the impact of the forest fire.
Yeah, it was really a moving moment in the book. How's the book changed you? Has it changed you?
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, this is my 5th book. I love writing, and I love talking to people about the books I write. This one in particular, I really liked because I interviewed more than 100 people. I think, you know, in the acknowledgments, I mentioned at least 60 that I call out and thank. And I love talking to those people, Mark Falk, Tom Lynch's of the world, all of them. They were just really great people. Bruce Kerfoot, Bruce and I think his wife's name is Nancy, but they're the owners of Gunflint Lodge, or they were. They've sold it now, but you know, all those people up there, they were just remarkable. The altruism, all of that stuff. I didn't know what I was going to experience or get into before writing this book, and those people really made it an interesting story and a valuable one, I think, to cover.
Yeah, I tell you what, it's a fascinating book and a real page-turner, Kerry. I want to thank you so much, and I hope you get a movie out of this.
Thank you. I hope so, too.
I hope so, too. Kerry Griffith is the author of Gunflint Burning, Fire in the Boundary Waters, and fascinating book published by Minnesota Society, University of Minnesota Press. That's what it is.
Yeah,
now I got it right. University of Minnesota Press. A fascinating book, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. It's one of the great books for summer reading. Thanks again, Kerry.
Thank you, Larry. I appreciate your time.
And you know what? Another good book, another book that you might enjoy reading. This is the time of year for page turners like Gunflint Burning, a time of the year for that. It's also the time of the year for a mystery maybe to read while you're on vacation or just enjoying the summer weather. And we'll talk with an author who's been with us a number of times, Victoria Houston. She's the author of the Loon Lake Mystery Series. That coming up next here on the Ideas Network.